makes this whole thing, you know, you just realize how lucky you are. I got my kids out with me this trip, and it's just like, you know.
And you have two kids.
Two, yeah. The 9-year-old and the 4-year-old. So my son was born 7 days before principal photography on margin call started. So he was he is a movie baby. He literally showed up on set, I think, like 3 days old or something. he doesn't know anything about it now. He's not actually a movie guy, but he was born on a movie set, basically. But what a ride.
It's been that long ago to me.
It's crazy. So that was when we shot it. So it was only 3.5 years ago when it came out. I mean, what a crazy 5 years I've had. It's like, I was just talking to Dave Poland, but can you imagine where I was? 4 years ago, I couldn't get anyone to read a script. Well, not four, but 6 years ago, I couldn't get anyone to, literally could not get a person to read a script of mine. You know, I got two people to read the margin call script, and then that grew into the movie. But I feel very fortunate.
Just take me back. Was it the Blacklist people didn't...
No, that movie was already shot when I got Blacklist. That was my junior agent at WME is an amazing, you know, young guy who's like great at that whole Blacklist thing. And so we had already shot the movie, but I think that's allowed. It's just supposed to be the script of that year, you know? So a lot of people love that script. But no, that movie got made because Neil Dodson, Zachary Quinto, and their other producing partner teamed up with me, and basically for the next 3 months, didn't really work on anything else. They completely, we teamed up in like the purest sense of the word and just started attaching actors and then hoped that the money would kind of follow. And of course the recession was like plummeting as we were doing that. It was literally like 5 years ago, 4.5 years, 5 years ago, I think. 5 years ago, exactly 5 years ago this spring. And, you know, there was like no money anywhere, but we had this great cast, and eventually, Cassian Elwes was fired from WME when it merged, and he went to Entitled just to have offices and kind of try to rebound and grow his business. And we were the first movie. Cassie and I sort of almost cry anytime we both see each other in sort of an emotional setting of one of, like, on that premiere night. It was pretty awesome. Because I'll never forget it. I was in a park in Providence, Rhode Island. We were living in Providence at the time because we couldn't even, like, afford to live in New York anymore. And so we had moved up there. And I was in this little park across the street from our house because I didn't want my wife to know that I was still, like, harboring hopes, you know, whatever. And, you know, and someone was like, oh, you know, Laura Rister, who was an amazing person at Untitled, like, she was in that packaging department there. And she's like, oh, there's, you know, somebody has just joined us who I want to bring on this call. And he gets on and he's like, hey, I'm Cassian Elwes, you know, in that voice. And I had read, what was the great book from the 90s when I was in high school? It was like, well, really a little later than that. It was like Easy Rider, Raging Bulls, and whatever. Was it a Biskin book? Yeah. So Cassian is a big character in that book because it's like early Sundance and like the deal making and, you know, Harvey in the bathroom and the whole nine yards making the deals. And he gets on the phone, and so I knew who he was and I knew exactly what he would do, and that he had helped 200 movies get made or something. And he got on the phone, and I told him this the other day, and he said, everyone was talking because we were about 6 months we'd been looking for money. Maybe not six, it was like November. So it's like 4 months of looking for money. And he's like, with this fucking script and this cast, like, I'm going to go get the money. And then it was like silence, right? Because no one had ever said that to me in their entire life. They never really had confidence in my writing enough to be like, I can actually finance this. It never happened. And I was sitting in the park looking, it's like over Providence, and like almost, I think I might have kind of started a little bit of a crying at that point, because it was like, I knew who Cassian was, and I was like, unless he's just a really mean jerk or something, and, you know, but he didn't say it that way. He said it just almost offhandedly, like, of course I'm going to find $1 million, you know, because he was like, what's the smallest amount of money you need to make this movie? And I was like, I don't know, I need like 1.2 with the tax credit, which was like 1.6 or something. And we ended up getting a little more than that, but, and he was like, I'm going to fucking find that, you know, and I was like, finally, you know, finally. And you know, a couple months later, we were at, well, I wasn't there, but they were selling my movie at, you know, not AFM, but at a Cannes, which is like an AFM, you know, the market in Cannes, with just
footage.
No, the movie hadn't been shot yet, so it was just the script, and it was Spacey and Zachary. Those were the three. So it was me, Spacey, and Zachary. But I was like, so it was basically the script, you know, and they sold like Germany and a couple other territories enough so that it was like the investor then, amazing kid Michael Van Roya, who's financed a bunch of first-time filmmakers, young guy who, you know, inherited a bunch of money, and but has really kind of gone about it in a pretty serious way, and you know, kind of like a, do not ever quote me saying this because it'll kill him, but like sort of like what Megan Ellison's doing, but on a little smaller scale, where he's really making interesting movies that like, but yet making money. He made, I'm very proud, he made a fortune off Margin Call. And so he came, and it was a Cassian find, and financed the whole thing. And from that point, you know, what a ride it's been the last 3 years.
During the party, the after party at the AFI Fest, you were saying, do not talk about the Javier thing. But everybody's been talking about it. It's been all over the place.
I know. I think I was talking about it too much, and I shouldn't be. I think that's why I said that. I was like, I should. It's just not fair to Oscar because he's made that character so much his own in such an unbelievable way. But yeah, you know, it's certainly a history part of it. But it, you know, he didn't want the thing to go in the direction that I did. And Oscar, you know, the first day I met Oscar, it was like, you know, everything Jessica had been saying to me, because they knew each other, you know, for 15 years. And so she had been kind of whispering in my ear at Telluride and stuff. And the first time I met him, that sort of, there's an energy, this like American, I mean, he literally was in a metal band from Miami and walked into an open call audition at Juilliard. And he'd never been through anything like that, and they were like, can you come back tomorrow morning? This was just a first open call, cattle call, basically. And
why were they doing that?
They do that. It's kind of cool.
They let people in for a little money or a pro bono?
And also they just want to see a broad spectrum. So you can kind of, and it's not the final deciders. It's like the junior teachers go to these open cattle call ones. I mean, some certainly come from regional theater departments where they're probably being, but they also do broad cattle calls, and they want to see raw talent. And so all you got to do is fill out the application and, you know, get yourself there. And he sort of, while he was doing a gig, could ask him this sometime, he's never actually told me, he obviously filled out some paperwork beforehand, but he basically was touring with this little rock band he was in, and he and they're like, come back tomorrow morning, and he came back, and it was the entire selection committee, because they knew he was leaving, and they knew he might just kind of poof, go into the distance, but he was so electric, right? So he walks in the next morning, and they had all six decision makers there, and ended up by the end of the day offering him a slot, but that's so like this character, right? You know, it's like that get up and go of sort of, it's like only in America, you know. And
you know, every character, I was gonna say, every time you see a character and you are, there's a point always in the first act when you decide you are sold on the character's capabilities, on his or her ability to weather storms.
Yeah.
To overcome, you know, either you buy into it, and every scene has that. Good example of Sea of Love, Pacino's.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, they're busting a bunch of guys,
right,
pretending it's a lottery thing.
Yeah.
And then a guy comes up with his son, and he says, hey man, I'm late for the thing. And Pacino says, no, it's over, man, you missed it. He says, you sure, man? And then he checks with his colleagues, what's this guy, what do we have on him? What's his rap sheet?
Right.
And it's relatively minor. He says, it's okay, man. Just forget it, you know.
Because he could have brought him in.
That sells you. He's a decent guy.
Right.
So right away, you say, okay, I'm with him.
I'm with him.
You know?
Fascinating. Because he could have brought him into the VIG and gotten him screwed, basically.
Yeah, could have done the whole thing.
Fascinating.
But he sold him with a kid. So right away, you're sold on him.
Right.
The Oscar scene in which you're sold on him is, of course, his sales pitch thing.
Yeah.
And this is not a guy who's just, you know, a hustler, but he's got a zen quality. You know?
Yeah.
He's not just sales, it's like belief, it's daring, but you know, all that stuff. That's when you say, okay, this guy can possibly, probably, I hope he makes it, because he's got something.
Yeah.
And it tells me that you guys were thinking about not even going the distance in that, right? The laughing, the guy's chuckled, and he said,
"He didn't.
Funny.
I got a. He wasn't. So I never was going to let him go. You know, there's the great thing I'm learning about myself as from my directing with my writing is I do like. I actually screwed up one scene that's not in the movie. It probably wouldn't have made it in the movie anyway. It was a little too sort of show-offy, but it. But there was writing stuff happening in there that, like, of course, you always miss as a writer. But Oscar and I, like, were working really well together, right? But I wasn't actually being like dictatorial enough. You know, I wasn't just like. No, right? You know, like, and sometimes you got to do that, and so because you know, they don't know, you know, they're so in the he is so alive in the moment, right? He's living it the way the character would be at that second, and my job is to keep always the movie in check, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I knew. I mean, that, he just killed that scene. That's actually a funny day. The morning is the. I think that's one of my best like little scenes in the movie, and the scene we shot that afternoon was so bad. Bradford Young, who shot the movie, and he and I have a really good rapport and everything, and we can kind of look at each other and kind of know what we're doing wrong or whatever. And the one that morning, he walked up to me and he's just like, "This is the greatest actor I've ever seen in my you know." And he's a DP, you know. He's like, so, but he's just like, "This guy is shredding this scene like nobody's business." And that afternoon, we were both walking by each other, and we were like, "This is hopeless." We're like, "I don't know." And we were like, "What are you going to do to fix this?" And I'm like, "I don't know. He looks like a game show host up there." It was like so funny. He was like talking to the drivers, and it literally looked like a bad like. Press conference, you know, where they're like, "And Steve and Jane," you know, like at like the city sanitation department or something, like, and then so I like ripped the what is it called, the like dais, you know, I'm like, "Get the dais out of there," like we tried everything and it was just a bad scene. But that morning where we did the other scene, it's like it was a magical one, you know. It was one of those mornings where like Oscar's like, and these young kids, those are young kids who are all pretty serious actors, like I cast pretty, you know, even for those two extra parts that don't actually really speak, but the kid who giggles and then the girl who like that woman who you really believe she wants to go out there and sell, you know, like she's like a 1981 upstart, you know, young, and you get that from those two. And so, you know, they're all watching Oscar do that scene like, you know, 12 times, just like boom, and like I'm making little changes. And so it's a pretty cool morning because like they're just sort of in an awe of a guy who's kind of in control of his craft at that time as actors, and we're just all having fun. You know, it's a good day.
You don't have to sell me about the resonance and the meaning and the way the movie comes alive in all sorts of ways.
No, you've been a big supporter, and I appreciate it.
For those who are saying, and I'm just being devil's advocate.
Police.
For those saying that this is actually kind of a film buffy think piece, esoteric, because it's addressing and it's part of a world that is not necessarily our world, it's very New York-centric in a wonderful, resplendent way, but you know, what's it telling me about my life, my culture, our times in the 21st century? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's obviously, I think, my movies, Oscar said this when I've been with him, which is, like, interesting, but, like, as an actor, he's like, the writing, you know, it's hard to say it myself because it just sounds so sort of self-important, but essentially, like, the way I'm trying to write is on the surface, like, I love a good 80s action movie, right? Like, you know, like, early Michael Bay and I, we got along really well, you know, and Michael's repped by my agent, so he's been very supportive of me over the years and has helped me in a lot of ways, but, like, you know, I love a good, you know, so, like, I want both things happening, which is like the movie to kind of operate like a good old-fashioned gangster film, right? You know, but obviously I also am interested, you know, to go through all this effort and have 500 people show up and help me make a movie and spend $20 million, like I want it to live and be, you know, be this thing that kind of that sticks with you, I guess. And not that those films can't, but that I think my writing, just what I feel comfortable with. And so, look, the guy is, I didn't realize this, but I was getting interviewed by the director of MoMA's film, who I know has been very supportive of me, Raj, who's a great guy, and he sort of looked at me and goes, I know you pretty well. We're on stage. He's like, I know you pretty well, you know, and you're a pretty kind, you know, like upbeat, sunny, like optimistic guy. Are you an optimist? Because these movies have this sort of darkness to them. And I sort of thought about it for the first time, and I was like, you know, this character is an optimist. And he looked at me, and the room actually giggled, right? Because when you're just finished watching the movie, that's hard to kind of think about. But what he is doing is, while everybody is jumping off the ship of New York City, so the entire 70s and 80s, property values are plummeting, tax base is plummeting, city's quality of life plummeting, this guy has finally, during that whole period, he's been stowing away money. He and his wife, they've been sucking it away, right? They got their like $500,000 or $600,000 stored away, and they now realize that prices, and like, this is the time where, like, of course this city's coming back, right? Like, you know, 1981, it's why I said it in this year. It's the most violent year in New York, which a lot of people are a little worried about the title. You know, like, why is it called a most violent year? Well, the reason is because it's their most violent year. It is the two characters in this movie who are normal humans on planet Earth, and they have seven of their trucks hijacked, and in a couple cases, the drivers beat up. An idiot tough, some moron, leaves a gun outside of their house where they thought they were moving away from the city for safety and all the reasons that everyone was doing white flight at that time and abandoning New York. One of their drivers makes a stupid mistake and actually has like a shootout. And at the end of it, Oscar gets pulled into, you know, his character actually gets pulled into this like physical confrontation, which is like the last thing he'd ever want to do, which is that whole chase sequence is meant to kind of like pull you into the violence, right? It's literally wooing him. It's like, come down the ramp, you know, follow me. It's like, I used to tell Oscar, what's happening to you in this sequence is, remember when there'd be like a daredevil cousin of yours or like your best friend, you know, who was always the daredevil one, and he'd kind of pull you to the park, and then he'd pull you up onto the mountain, and then he'd pull you over to the edge of that thing, and then you guys decided to maybe roll a boulder off the thing, and you know, mm-hmm. And that sequence is literally, it's like being wooed into the violence, right? You know, he doesn't want to go into that tunnel, but so the city chose not to go that path, right? So in 1981 it was the most violent year, and New York City could have chosen, you know, to become Beirut, basically, and everyone was arming themselves. Bernie Goetz shot someone on, you know, a lawyer shot someone on the subway, and 50% of the city thought that was okay.
Goetz.
That's how, like, yeah, it's like, that's how crazy, I think Goetz was a lawyer. But he was a workaday guy, but he was carrying a handgun. A youth looked at him the wrong way, and he shot the guy dead. For his defense was implied harm, something like that. I can't remember. I should go back and look at it. But his formal defense was that something was going to happen to me. Not that something did, right? You know, the city had a choice, just like this group of immigrants who, like, were running these businesses. You know, Oscar's character has a choice of what path he's going to go down. And New York is where it is now, which some would say is like a little too Disney-fied at this point, but this civilization, this little group of people that's living on the planet, was able to significantly alter the path of the city, and they chose a different path, and that allowed a nonviolent path for the most part, you know, making it an urban, you know, goal to get guns off of, and not out of any sort of ethical argument against it, but mainly because of Abel's argument, which is pragmatic, right? It's like, sure, when I'm deer hunting in the woods, a gun is very helpful. 7 million people living on top of each other, guns not so hot, right? It's like, and so I think, you know, the movie hopefully like keeps you entertained and keeps you on a mission, but like there's a lot there if you sort of listen to what he's saying, you know. But you gotta listen, and that's not for everybody. The movie was never intended for everybody. So,
the guy who plays the so the main truck jacker,
yeah,
is the guy from Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't recognize him at first.
I know it's Chris Abbott. He's a friend of mine.
Did you tell him to what he gained?
He's done that. So he has totally transformed himself. He was at risk, and this is him speaking. I mean, I'm speaking for him, but he had become such a sort of heartthrob that final season of Girls, and then I guess they wouldn't pay him as a regular.
That's right, he quit.
Yeah, he quit in the middle of the show because they had him to some contract that was like, I don't know what the finances are, but it's called like a guest star as opposed to a series regular. And so I think it's a pretty significant difference. And yet they were like marketing the whole show on him being the like cute guy. And he's a very serious, naturalistic actor. He's from a town next door. He's from Stamford, Connecticut, right next to where I live. And he totally transformed himself, you know, and is. And he's just physically, he's a bigger guy. And so he's not this like waify little hipster guy. Yeah. And these are the kind of roles he wants to play. I actually offered him a different role, and he loved this role. He was like, I can make something of this role, and he did. You know, he made that the bad guy, the classic gangster movie bad guy.
I love the way you have them arguing.
Well, that's on the bridge, which I love. He brought that one line where he goes, there's people out here, you idiot. You know, it's like, dude, we're just doing a business transaction. Like, I'm ripping you off, and I know it's not you, it's your boss. I'm not ripping you off. So, like, let me take the fucking truck, and, like, then we'll move on, you know? And, like, you're going to do this shooting thing, we're going to get ourselves in some real trouble here. And there was, he brought such a great, like, you know, because it's a very important character, because in the end, it's who Oscar, you know. And so that moment would never have been the same if the bad guy was just some schmutz who's always like fucking up. You literally would have been like, kill the fucker, you know? Right. Which you sort of are anyway, but like you really would have. You wouldn't have understand why he didn't, right? If the guy was purely evil and been doing that all to him, like.
That's the interesting thing. In all movies, we've been told over and over again, in I don't know how many hundreds of movies, that if you get into a shootout in a public space, it's going to just happen and move on. Nobody's going to say a thing. No consequences, no cops, no nothing.
Never see the cleanup. You never see the...
You're the first movie
that... I wanted to like actually show the cleanup thing, and then I realized Abel would never have actually risked himself going... You know, he would have been like, he didn't want anything to do with it, but I actually wanted him to go up on the bridge because I was like, that's what... But I think we did it anyway. Those chase sequences feel... He's wearing leather suit, shoed loafers in that chase, and he was like, when he falls, it's because he fell in real life and stuck with it as an actor, which is amazing. But he, I wanted those action sequences to feel like the kids walking up the hill, right? Yeah. When you're getting nervous and you're like, am I really gonna go jump off this cliff with my crazy cousin? And those things were supposed to feel, you know, like what it feels like to chase someone, which, you know, is scary.
A24 should pass those hats out as swag.
I know. Well, I'm gonna get you one. Because they're for every, literally we've, so Quinn.